Hey, everybody, it's CJ Graham. That's right, Jason Voorhees, Friday the 13th, part 6. And you're listening to Guess What? You're Wrong, a horror movie podcast. Just want to let you know that if you can make it to the end, you lived through it. If not, you died. Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls, welcome to a spine-tingling new episode of Guess What? You're Wrong, with your host, Big D. That's right, folks. The spooky season has arrived, and we're not clowning around. This year, we're delving headfirst into the eerie world of clown-based horror. So, whether you're a seasoned horror enthusiast or just a curious soul looking for a thrill, fasten your seatbelts, because we're about to take you on a chilling ride through the carnival of nightmares. So grab your grease paint, your oversized shoes, and your funny nose if you dare, because beneath the painted smiles and colorful costumes lies a world of darkness and suspense. Join us as we unravel the mysteries, confront the fears, and explore the twisted minds behind these macabre entertainers. Now grab a front row seat and prepare for a twisted, terrifying, and utterly thrilling experience. Welcome to Guess What? You're Wrong, the podcast that proves in the world of horror your worst nightmares might just be right around the corner.
Now, before we get into this episode too far, I just got a little disclaimer here. First off, all audio used in this podcast is used under the protection of fair use. And as with all the movie reviews that I do here on Guess What? You're Wrong, we're going to spoil the hell out of every single thing we talk about. So, you have been warned.
Damn hotel.
Damn Skype.
Telling you. Hello and welcome back to another spectacularly machete-wielding episode of Guess What? You're Wrong. Now today, we do have a special treat today. I'm not talking about the guest. I'm talking about the movie we're going to be covering. Today, I'm actually going to be covering Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, with none other than Gilman and Joel from the Retro Movie Geek Podcast. How you doing, Joel?
I am here. I am happy to be covering this movie. You are, in fact, correct. This movie is the treat. We are in for a treat for the fact that we get to cover this one.
Yeah, this movie is... I love this movie. Got to tell you.
I have controversial opinions. Oh, actually, maybe they're not that controversial. About Where this ranks in the series.
Okay. Well, let's dive in. Let's see...
Do you need synopsis? Although I feel like anybody listening to this would probably not need it.
Yeah. Do you have a synopsis there?
Camp counselors.
Yeah. I know. Oh, here they are. Okay. I found my notes. I love it when I'm ready. All right. A brief synopsis. Tommy Jarvis. See, this is what's exciting too. Tommy Jarvis exhumes Jason Voorhees to cremate his corpse, but inadvertently brings him back to life. The newly revived killer seeks revenge, and Tommy may be the only one who could stop him. There you go.
All right, look, credit where credit's due, because usually IMDb synopses are horrible.
I know.
That one was pretty much on target.
I know. I've read some of these IMDb synopses, and I'm like, what movie are they talking about?
They're in, like, broken English, and they make whoever wrote them is like a word salad. Like, they just don't even make sense.
Yeah. So, as we know, this movie stars Jason Voorhees, or I'm sorry, CJ Graham as Jason Voorhees. Kind of does star Jason Voorhees. And Tom Matthews as Tommy. Now, the character of Tommy Jarvis. We're first introduced to Tommy Jarvis in part four.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you remember what he's famous for?
Corey Feldman?
Well, I was looking for it. He's the one that actually killed Jason. But yeah, Corey Feldman as well.
Yeah. It's also the fact that he was the Corey Feldman who had the amazing makeup skills of Tom Savini at the tender age of like 11 or 12 or whatever he was supposed to be in that movie.
Spectacular. Yeah. And, you know, in part four, and this is one of the reasons why I love this Friday is because it finishes that Tommy Jarvis arc that started in four. In part five, a lot of people don't really like it. I liked part five mainly because it furthered the story of Tommy Jarvis. And then, of course, this part six finishes off that Tommy Jarvis arc there. What'd you think about Tommy Jarvis?
So, Tommy Jarvis fan, okay? I am a fan. But I think I'm specifically a Tom Matthews as Tommy Jarvis fan.
Yes, I can.
So, yeah. I feel like with part four, with Corey Feldman, I mean, he is the main, for lack of a better way of putting it, because it's really hard to point to anybody else in that movie who would be the quote-unquote final girl of the movie,
yeah,
right? And whereas even five has someone who I would argue could be kind of considered, because Tommy's in it, but it's weirdly like he's not sidelined. I mean, he's obviously a element, but it's almost like there's more of a group. There's like a small band of people in five that are trying to stop, and I'm using air quotes, I know one can see right now, Jason in that movie. Which I will say, you know, here's the thing about five. I always have gone on the I don't like it side. However, I feel like I should revisit it because I didn't dislike it just because it wasn't really Jason. Spoiler alert. I think it was more, for whatever reason at that point, I just remember always being super annoyed by that mom and son, the backwoods mom and son that were just obnoxious. And I feel like if I with a different attitude into it, because there are things about it that I do like. Yep. But and it was actually, I saw all these movies completely out of order as a kid. And five was actually one of the first, it wasn't the first one, thank God, but it was one of the first ones that I saw. And again, I think I, as a kid, especially, it was funny because revisiting these movies, they're like just chicken soup for me. They're just like these, you know, nostalgia,
yeah,
almost like just comfort food. But as a kid, the music, and I was a pretty sensitive little kid. So like the gore effects were just, they just freaked me out. Like I thought these movies were terrifying. You know what I mean? And when you watch them now, you're like, not so terrifying, but they're fun. But yeah, so for me, six, Jarvis and six, Tom Matthews is the best one. I like Tom Matthews. I like him in Return of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead Part 2. And Roxanne, right? Wasn't he the not-so-smart friend in Roxanne with Steve Martin? And so I've always liked him. I always thought he was, you know, I like that he kind of gives it his all. And this, although his character in this in some ways feels similar to the character he plays in Return of the Living Dead and Return of the Living Dead Part 2. I don't know if that's just Tom Matthews or, you know,
I think
or what.
Just Tom Matthews.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that as one thing that makes this series somewhat unique is that all the other ones, by and large, not completely. I mean, I'm sure we have, like, you know, we can, if we really stop thinking about it for 2 seconds, there are other examples. But by and large, it was always Final Girls, right?
Yeah.
So you get Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is a final guy, but this was the one series where they actually treated it like this was somebody they were going to keep going with.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan. I like it.
Yeah, I like the, I have a nephew that ever since he's 18 now, but ever since he was a little kid, his name is Tommy. And ever since he was 2-3 years old, I've been calling him Jarvis. And at first he hated it, but then as he got older, he got to realize what it was for. And he's grown to like it a little bit. I've always been a big fan of the Tommy Jarvis, the character, starting in 4 and how they, you know, I mentioned the Tommy Jarvis arc, you know, through those 3 films. And I really liked how they played that, you know, they're different actors and stuff. But, you know, you can follow the character's growth or lack thereof growth throughout those 3 movies and, you know, culminating in this one. And Tom Matthews does a great job. I'm a big Tom Matthews fan as well. You know, huge, huge fan of The Return of the Living Dead. And actually going to meet Linnea Quigley next week. So that's
nice.
Fun. But this part 6, I don't know. I could say it's a nostalgia thing as well, but you know, every time I watch it, I've seen it probably at least 3-4 dozen times at least. I love part 6 and the music, you know, we have the Alice Cooper songs, of course.
Of course.
Yes. You know, and I remember, well, before we get into that, when was the first time you saw this? How old were you, would you say?
Okay. So the first Friday the 13th movie that I know I saw 3 and 4 with my cousin, who was about 5 years older than me, and he was a big horror fan. It was like the older brother that I didn't have was my older cousin, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when I would go visit my dad on the weekends, I would hang out with him sometimes, and that's how I got to see a lot of things I really wasn't supposed to see. And 3 and 4 were like the first ones I saw.
Because you had a dad that loved you, right?
Was that? Oh, yes, because I didn't have a dad that loved me. Yes, unlike some people that we know. And part 5, though, I feel like would have been right in that same window. So I'm thinking 11. I was around 11-ish when I saw it. And so that would have been 1987, give or take. So as far as part five goes.
Yeah.
Six, I would have seen probably shortly thereafter. So I'm going to say like by around 12 or so, because my friend JL and his brother Wade, we were all friends. We were very close to them, their family. Their parents were like the really cool parents that were very involved in every, because I had some friends who had parents who, God love them, didn't really pay attention to anything we did. And we could have done, I mean, well, and sometimes occasionally illegal things were done, but they were just completely unaware, in that classic way that, you know, Gen X kids had the baby boomer parents who were just former hippies who didn't pay attention to anything. And my friend JL, though, his parents were very involved, but they would let us rent pretty much any horror movie. They'd be like, hey, let's go to JL's house. And we watched a ton of Friday the 13th movies. And I think that's where I first saw it. So I would have been around 12, maybe 13 when I first saw this. So like 88, 89, somewhere in that time frame. And I loved it. Like, I think this one, and I'm sure we'll get into this, has a different, and I'm sure maybe for some of you, that's why they don't maybe rank this one as high, because there's definitely a sense of humor in this that a lot of the early, certainly the ones earlier than it, did not have, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then I mean, five, I think, kind of tried to do it, but they almost camped it up too much, like the aforementioned backwoods mom and son and that kind of stuff. But this one, I think, is really truly you could point to as like a proto 90s horror flick, in that it predates Scream, but it has a lot, you can hear, you can sense those Scream vibes of being aware that it's a horror movie that's happening. Yep. Like Scream, and unlike other movies that I will be more critical of in this regard, what I love is that all of the characters are terrified. All of the characters are treating like what's happening to them is life and death, as they should be. You know, even if the movie itself has an awareness of what it is, there's the characters within the world that they're in, it's life and death. And that is exactly how it should be. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, boy, I remember before I saw this movie, it came out in 86, and I only got to see the good horror movies when I went to visit my cousin. So came out in 86. I remember I was in seventh grade and I read the novelization of it. Because I wasn't able to actually see the movie yet. So, you know, I went down to the bookstore and they were selling the Friday the 13th Part 6 Jason Lives book. So I had read that and I was thrilled. I was so excited to see this. And then finally I went to visit my cousin. It had to have been in 87, about a year later, I finally got to see it. But I loved it, you know, and it was one of those, I've always been a big Friday the 13th fan, but, and I love the campiness, you know, and you mentioned in part five, they almost did overcamp. It's almost like they took some of these tropes and went, and that's why, one of the reasons why people don't really like it, because they went really hardcore on a lot of that stuff, you know, the boobs dumb people getting killed, and the way they did this, you know, wasn't terrible. I still like part five for the Tommy Jarvis story and, you know, those damn enchiladas, you know, but
that's rough, man. That was one of the rougher scenes.
But, you know, when you're coming into part six, it almost feels to me like this part six, well, we know that part six is the one to create, it actually makes Jason Voorhees like the living zombie.
Yes.
This, he was just, well, he wasn't in part five, but in part four, he was just a very strong, you know, a kid from the grew up in the woods.
Yes. Yeah.
Tommy Jarvis.
Yeah, I think the only thing I could figure, the only thing I could figure out, though, is because if you think about what he goes through in parts one through four prior to Tommy, you know, taking it to him with the machete.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, because obviously they've always said he was meant to, you know, have that, you know, what is it called? Mongoloidism or whatever, where, you know, he's extreme in his deformity and in his, you know, handicaps that he has. But I don't know why, what the implication always has been that he didn't drown, and that he just went off into the woods and became kind of like a mountain man. But other people have argued, no, he did drown, and seeing his mother die created what's, I guess it's called a revenant, which is a vengeful spirit. So, but if you think about it, until you get to this movie, though, this is where he's full zombie, because he's definitely dead going into this movie. I mean, he is 100% dead.
Yeah. And that whole scene where Tommy Jarvis pulls up, you know, opens the casket, and first thing, this past time, when I watched it, the first thing I thought of was, why are there maggots on him still?
Oh, you didn't think, why did they bring Horshack into the movie?
When I first, I remember when I first saw this, I was like, hey, but yeah, the first thing I thought of was, why are there still maggots on?
He's been dead
for years. I mean, I can see bugs and worms and stuff like that because, you know, but maggots?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing is like the timeline. And that's a funny thing to me. I think there have been people that have tried to create a timeline for Friday the 13th movies because in some cases, like presumably between part two and three, aren't they? They're supposed to pretty much be happening in the same week. And in fact, memory serves, Friday the 13th 3 is technically not even on Friday the 13th because of the way Friday the 13th 2 is, the way Friday the 13th 3 picks up. Three to four. That's what it is. From three to four, because three ends, they get the body, they take it to the coroner, right? And then we just keep going. That's what it is.
That's when he comes back.
Yeah, that's so. But between one and two, there's a decent amount of distance, but not insane. But for two to three, I think. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember if three has got as big a one, but then three to four, there's barely any, but then four to five, we go from Tommy being like 12 years old to being in his mid 20s.
Yeah.
So presumably we've just jumped ahead 12 years. If you want to be generous and say, okay, he's supposed to be 18 years old. It's still like 6 year difference. Yeah, and then you get to this movie and now he looks like he's definitely into his mid to later 20s. And so I really don't know where the heck I was going with that. But the point is the timeline is very screwed. I think somebody figured out once that if you follow the timeline from part one to at least part 10, well, obviously not part 10 because that goes way into the future, but part 9 or whatever, it ends up like should be like the year 2065 or it's something ridiculous.
Yeah. But this also is, I think after this, the whole tone of the Friday the 13th movies change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we move it after this. We have 7, which the girl has telekinesis, you know, the new blood.
Sure, sure.
You know, and then, of course, the ever popular Jason Takes Manhattan.
Now, here's what this is a controversial take. I do like part 8. I will admit. Yeah. I kind of like part 8. It's not great. I acknowledge it's not a great movie.
I like part 10.
Yeah, I do too. Ready for really controversial? I kind of have a soft spot for part 9. That's how sad I am.
Jason goes to hell, right?
Correct.
It's a Jason movie. You know, it's Kane Hodder. I mean,
yes. Well, yeah, exactly. And also, it was the first one I got to in the theater because for whatever reason, 8 should have probably been because I think my dad would have probably let me go because I was 89, right?
Yeah.
So I'd have been about 13. And I mean, he took me to see Pet Sematary that year and Lord of the Flies. And then, you know, within a year or two after that, People Under the Stairs. So, I mean, he would have probably let me go. But for whatever reason, I didn't get to see 8 in the theater, but 9 was my first official, okay, I got to go see it in the theater. And so liked it at the time. And I'm obviously the whole thing with Freddy Claw coming up at the end. I thought was great. You know, because I'm like 17 years old. But I think I get why people don't like it. But again, I have a soft spot. And to your point, I also like 10. Yes.
Yeah. Jason X, I think, was spectacular.
It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah. It's like a sci-fi, you know, if you're a sci-fi geek, you can watch it and get your sci-fi horror on. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. It also has some very clever and amusing kills in it.
Yes, it does.
I'll be honest with you, I don't know how you feel about it. And I'm notorious for being not very kind to remakes of any sort. But I waited forever to see the remake or reboot or whatever the heck you want to call it. But I didn't hate it. It wasn't my favorite, but
That's the one with Sam Winchester in it?
Yes, exactly.
Padalecki.
The Winchester Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hate that. I mean,
yeah, it was entertaining. Again, it was entertaining. I felt like it had the right Jason vibes. I think there were some things about it I also love that they felt like they tried to shoehorn in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Plus, it was the whole like Platinum Dunes era, right? When Michael Bay's producing,
yes,
you know, a lot of these reboots and retreads. But it wasn't horrible.
Yeah, it wasn't terrible at all. I mean, when I originally saw that reboot or the remake, whatever you want to call it, I think I was a little upset with it for various reasons, you know, but I think watching it again, I mean, I've probably seen it about half a dozen times. I mean, I don't hate it.
Yeah.
I think it has its place, but I think I do love Jason versus Freddy.
You know, I saw that in the theater and I remember at the time liking it. And then for whatever reason, somewhere in there, I kind of like a little lukewarm on it. But then over the subsequent years, I sort of warmed up to it again.
Yeah.
It's weird. Nostalgia is a funny thing. It's like that early 2000s era at the time, because, you know, the CGI was not great and they were trying to overuse it on everything. Yep. And just certain things just didn't work. But then now you go back and it almost has this like quaint quality to it. Yeah.
I remember I saw, the most memorable Friday that I saw in the theater was 8. I saw that. It was in Cleveland. Yeah, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, visiting some family, went to a theater to see it, and we were on the wrong side of town, I guess you could say, and it was a rough crowd, I guess, to see it. I mean, me and my brother were the only light-skinned people in that theater.
Yeah, and, I mean, that's sometimes those fun experiences.
But honestly, with that movie, because how Friday the 13th Part 8 is, Jason Takes Manhattan, and people are yelling at the screen, and it's fun. That was one of the movie going experiences that I was like, man, this was actually kind of fun.
Yes. It's always like what reminds you of why movie theaters have to be around.
Yep.
Because it's that communal experience that you just don't get when you're sitting there at home with your family or by yourself.
Yep.
You just don't get that. Look, I mean, on one hand, it's great. We could watch wherever we want, when we want, at home, and that's great. And people always make their own, well, yeah, but then I go to a theater and I have to pay all this money. And I, don't get me wrong, the prices are ridiculous. But I think that that is why that experience matters. Because when you're in a group of people that are into the movie and they're just, you know, hooting and hollering and throwing stuff at the screen, it's just fun. Now, do I want that experience when I'm, you know, watching some dramatic movie? Not that I'm prone these days to go see too many of those in the theater. But let's just say hypothetically I was. Like if I was going to, when I went to go see Good Will Hunting, I don't think I would have enjoyed it, you know, had it like that, if that had been the scenario. But this kind of movie, it's, and honestly, I would say for Part 8, maybe even especially, because back then, I think most people were just really miffed that, okay, it was a bit of false advertising because he's in New York, quote unquote, for like all of about 20 minutes. And where he really was what, Vancouver, if memory serves. So it was a bit of a bait and switch, and I think people were a little miffed, understandably. But I think, yeah, seeing that with a fun crowd.
Oh, it was a blast. It was a blast. Yeah. And, you know, you're right. There are certain movies that you want everybody to shut up and watch the movie. But, yeah, when you're watching these types of movies, I mean.
Because it's not like you're going, oh, I got to follow. I'm trying to listen to the dialogue.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Although this one has some good dialogue. This actually one has some funny lines, in my opinion.
Yeah, it does. I tried to destroy him, but I fucked up.
What did you say?
He says, I tried to destroy him, but I fucked up.
Yeah, or one of my personal favorites in any horror movie ever is one kid turning to the other kid and said, so what were you going to be when you grew up?
Yeah, real dead.
Yeah, real dead.
This is the use of the special effects in this as well is really good.
Yeah.
These kill scenes. You know, the whole scene where you have the, I don't know, the company outing where they're out there
playing. Oh, the paintball. Yeah.
That whole scene is just, it's funny, but not, I guess.
Yeah. The only, and I've always had this beef, this one moment. I'll see if you can guess which one it is. It's in that sequence, right? The paintball sequence. There's only one moment where I feel like the humor went too far. It was a bit of a, not jumping the shark, but it was definitely a, everything else in the movie by and large is more subtle, right? So, you know, when the director's Tom McLaughlin, who I'm sure we'll mention here in a little bit, but his wife, I believe, is in the scene with Tony Goldwyn when they're in the little VW bug, the camp counselors that meet Jason on that dark road.
You ain't dirty Harry.
Yeah, you ain't dirty Harry. Yeah, exactly. He's got his little pea shooter gun. And she takes that spear to the face or the mouth. But then they show her American Express, which it's funny. Those are the kind of jokes that were probably hysterical in 1986 because all those, you know, never leave home without it commercials were always on TV. But now no one even gets the joke. But that's a subtle thing, right? That's subtle. And it's one of those jokes that even if it doesn't translate to today because it was of its time, it just seems like it's just holding on her money and it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But there's a scene in the paintball. There's a moment in the paintball scene where it's because it could never happen. Like it literally couldn't happen. And well, yes, I realize, really, Joel, you're talking about a movie about a guy that comes back from the dead after having wrought iron shoved through his chest and lightning hitting him. Actually, one of my sons, because we'll have to get into the fact that I actually watched this with all three of my sons.
Oh, nice.
This is their first Friday the 13th movie. They've never watched one before.
Nice.
So I wanted to start them off on the right foot, and much like I did, out of order. So the point is, I get that the entire premise of this movie is ridiculous, but let's set that aside for a second. If you go with the premise, the moment in the paintballs, you know what I'm talking about, what I'm driving at, the joke that I think is dumb and pointless.
Is it the smiley face thing?
Yes, it is the freaking smiley face.
Yep.
And if they had established that smiley face was already carved into the tree and he just happened to hit it face on and left a blood splatter, fine. But that is not what they set up. Now, maybe that was like a missing footage that they just didn't include because of the cut or whatever. But they make it seem like his face went smashing into a tree and it left the imprint of the classic, you know, happy have face. A nice day smiley face.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's stupid.
Yeah. I can agree with that.
Like, obviously, there's zero way that can ever happen. And so this isn't like if this was a movie like Scary Movie, like those kind of parody movies, then fine. That would make sense, that kind of dumb joke. But in this movie, and this is what I mean, it's like I like that all of – because even that's the campiest scene in the whole movie. Like I think if people that tend to gripe about this movie, that scene they tend to gripe about the most because it's the goofiest, it's the campiest. It's really unnecessary just to get a few extra kills in the movie. But by and large, all of the carnage that happens, while there's obviously a lot of humor layered in there, there is like a sense of there's some good gore effects and there's a sense of the characters themselves are properly terrified and, you know, die the way they should. And it's not over the top, goofy, wink at the camera. But that one scene, and I even mean compared to the scene with the caretaker, when the caretaker's burying the body and he looks right at the camera, breaks the fourth wall. I'd say some folks got a sick idea of entertainment, right?
Yeah. See, he actually looked. We're looking at, they're filming from the foot of the. Because I thought that first as well, but then after the rewatch, I don't think he's actually looking right at the camera. I think he's looking at the leg that's hanging out of the coffin.
I think he initially, the way I took it, I've always taken it, and then, you know, like I just watched it. Maybe you're right. I have to go back and really like study his eye line. But the way his eye line goes, he looks directly into the lens.
Yeah,
he definitely looks into the lens. So I would say if they wanted it to be like he's looking at the foot, the camera should have been like at a much lower angle and further away, and then I would totally buy that. But I think either way, it was obviously meant to be a wink at the audience, right? That he's talking to us and making fun of us. But again, I'm fine with that. That doesn't bother me. But that dumb smiley face thing bothers me because, like, you know, we even compare it to when Court's girlfriend or whatever, or I guess one night stand, gets her face slammed into the RV. As goofy as that is, like, as if the imprint of your face would go through the metal like that, and not just like, you know, the bones wouldn't just snap and collapse and turn into mush. You know, at least it still has the form of a normal face and it makes sense. But the smiley face thing is really dumb.
You're stuck on that.
I really am. I really am.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I can understand what you're talking about on that. I mean, I never really thought I always thought that it was just, you know, it's just a coincidence that his face hit that spot.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. If they would have showed that earlier, even if they're walking through the forest, if they would have just panned across it and you see it.
And maybe we did. Maybe somebody out there could write in and correct to me and say, oh yeah, there's this one moment you have to really pay attention, but you could totally see it. And I think then I will take it back and I will not be upset about it. But unless you can show me evidence that stupid smiley face existed prior to his head hitting that tree, then the implication of the way they shot that sequence is that his face left that mark and that makes zero sense.
Yep, I agree. But you know, and then back to Roy, the nerdy little guy that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He looks like Eddie Deason. Does he remind you of Eddie Deason a little bit?
He's just hilarious because, of course, he has to shoot Jason with some paintballs.
Paintball. Yeah.
Thinking that he's going to get away. But you know, they end up finding his body torn apart later on. Of course, they're blaming Tommy Jarvis for this whole deal. I mean, and this is when we talk about this movie and all the fuck ups that Tommy does. I mean,
oh, I know,
you know, it's just like over and over, you know, he charges into the sheriff's department or office and he almost gets shot there. And then he's screaming about going out Jason's back and, you know, so much this character. I don't know. But
well, he's if it wasn't for him, the movie doesn't even happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't.
The classic, the protagonist sets the entire freaking thing in motion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if he would have just, even when that wrought iron thing got stuck in there, that was his first mistake, you know, getting freaking out and then hitting him with that fence post or whatever it was. But even if he would have, after that got stuck there, if he would have just burnt him up then and let it sure. be. But yeah, I guess the lightning storm would have happened again anyway. But if he would have just,
I get what you're saying. But I think that from my point of view, and I always go back to, you know, looking at the sort of context of what we're being given with the character.
Yeah.
With this character, who's had all of these traumatic events and all he's been through, does at least make sense on some level? Is it somewhat relatable that a person in a similar situation who obviously has had some disconnect with reality, right? Because he was locked away in an asylum for a period of time. We saw how part five ended, where the implication was he was going to become the new Jason.
Yeah.
And so all of that being what it is, and maybe that goes to that idea of a person being so consumed by something, you know, the idea that, I'm going to get really heady on you here for a second, but think about like Carl Jung and the Jungian idea of the shadow self. And that whole idea of like the things we tend to hate in others the most are things we actually deep down are part of our own darkest side. And when we lash out at other people over things, especially when we're being super judgy, like, you know, a lot of us can be like pretty much everybody in some way, shape or form. Yeah. But if you really think about it, a lot of times, it's because there's something in that or your perception of that person that you hate about yourself. Well, it stands to reason if Tommy Jarvis came, you know, this close to becoming the next Jason, there's a couple of factors. There's obviously the, you know, you destroyed my family, you destroyed my life, I want revenge, but he knows he's dead. So, but then there's also the maybe he's not. I went through this whole previous movie where somebody came back as him. I just need closure to see the body, to be sure and make sure once and for all that if I cremate it, which, okay, I follow the logic, makes sense. If you cremate a body, it ain't coming back no matter what. And then when you put all that together and then he sees it and they were smart to give us a little bit of that soundbite of Corey Feldman, die. And all of that. So all of that being what it is, you could see how that emotional baggage, the fear of you becoming the monster you hate, et cetera, et cetera. I buy him losing his crap, grabbing, and again, it's total plot contrivance to grab that particular item because that would get the lightning's blast. But I mean, the deeper issue is how would this person who's presumably now been in a hole for the better part of 10, 15 years, if we're being generous, who's he was total worm food. And when he stabs him, you know, he's like almost like paper mache.
There's nothing
there to use the lightning on. I mean, we think about like the Frankenstein story, Dr. Frankenstein's monster. He had to have the freshest body parts possible of corpses. It wasn't like he's, hey, give me something that's totally, you know, like mummified.
You have to understand the regenerative powers of lightning.
That is fair.
You know?
That's a fair point.
it can create tissue.
Yeah. One of my sons is very, very scientifically minded, right? My oldest. And he's like, so I'm curious, Dad, how does a lightning blast basically rebuild muscle and organs?
Eyes, and even?
I said, go with it, is what I said. I said, just go with it. Okay.
Yeah. That's one thing. I mean, like you were saying, his body is pretty much, I mean, it's decayed.
It's desiccated.
And having that lightning, you know, just completely regenerating body tissue. Yeah, your son's right.
To be fair, though, and I know there's someone out there listening that's screaming this right now, because I know I would be if I was listening to us, the eyeball.
Yeah.
Like the perfect, absolutely healthy eyeball that opens when he opens it. And you think, okay, if you want to make the argument, and I am really going out on a limb here, if you want to make the argument, whatever, through the magical juju of this movie, the lightning goes through a wrought iron fence, courses through this desiccated, mummified looking paper mache husk of a body. And somehow that experience, you know, Horace Pinker shocker style, creates, regenerates all this tissue and the muscle, everything. Okay. And so presumably they did that with his eye, and maybe that's the implication.
Yeah.
But you, and I get that this is all practical effects. This is even harder to pull off, but you think like maybe when the eye starts to open at first, it might look all like it's sunken in and, you know, and then it slowly comes back. But if you think about the rest of that movie, by and large, the eyes are blacked out. You don't see that eye again, really, until the, if memory serves, until the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a weird choice anyway. Like, why did he need to have the, I get because it's like, oh, it's staring at you into your soul. It looks cool. But I don't know. I feel like you probably could have gotten away with there being no eyeball and that would have been fine.
Yeah. Cause it, yeah, you're right. That is one thing that, how in the hell did he get an eyeball?
Yeah, perfect. It's a healthy eye. There's no, I don't think it's bloodshot.
But the most important thing now is that we know that he has brown eyes.
Yes, although don't they fluctuate? Because in the trivia, they said there's actually, I guess, two different people that played Jason. Apparently, the first person was crew member Dan Bradley, and he was on the first day of shooting. And they said that's why Jason's build was different in the paintball scene. So I guess this guy was bigger than they said, because I guess they basically thought he looked too bulky. So CJ Graham, and there is, if you think about it, there is a little bit of a difference. Like now that they brought that up, when I think about it, because I think it's in the paintball scenes, at least initially, he does look bigger. Like there's a little bit, it's not like massive. I mean, it's not like a huge disparity between the two, but yeah. So I think that maybe, and they said that that was one of the reasons why the, I guess the eye does change color a bit, but I think it seemed like it was brown though, but maybe it's just a different shade of brown. I don't know if it, because I don't remember it being like completely different.
Yeah, who knows? With
whatever.
Friday the 13th, the Megan, the I guess the one that's supposed to be the final girl on this one-ish.
Yeah, I'd say the fine-ish girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is hilarious because I even remember as a kid thinking of this, and I still think it now as an almost 50-year-old man. First of all, she's a very attractive woman.
Yeah.
But she's supposed to be, I'm going to guess, what, 18, 19? And I don't mean this in any way to, like, disparage or, but I, what I think it's hilarious to this movie is if she's younger than 25 or 26, I feel like I'd eat my hat. And I didn't look up her actual age.
But I didn't look that up either.
She did not pass for, like, a late teen camp counselor.
No.
At all.
Yeah, that was Jennifer Cook, right?
Yes.
Plays
yes.
That. Yeah. She's been in has she been in much else? She was in.
Actually, she was 22 when they made this. So, I was going to say maybe at the most early 20s.
Yeah.
She was 22. And I don't know, maybe it's the hairstyles back then, but to me, they all look older.
Yeah.
When you know what I mean? Like, I think 22 now, and maybe, of course, part of this could be because I'm pushing 50. but it's like, a 22-year-old to me now looks so young.
Yeah.
Even now, though, when I watch her, you know what I'm saying? Like, she doesn't look that young to me. Yeah. She looks younger than I am now, but she doesn't look like a 20. I think, does that make sense? What I'm trying to say?
It's like, absolutely.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah. You know, I find myself, you know, sometimes, you know, out and about, and I'll see a woman, I'll be like, oh, she's cute. And I'd be like, oh, wait, she's only like 20. God damn it.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And you're like, yeah, that's kind of, it feels weird.
It does. It feels very weird. And I'm like, nope, she's old enough to be my daughter. I can't do that. No.
Yeah. Or how about that moment when you realize that somebody who's like 30 is old enough to be your kid?
Oh, Joel, you're making me feel old. Stop.
Yeah. You're like, oh, dear God.
Man, what do you think as far as kill scenes in this movie? What do you think is the one that stands out the most?
My favorite, and it's a very simple one, is Sheriff Garris.
Oh, the bend backwards?
Getting the back bend.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was harsh.
David Kagan is the actor. I remember seeing behind the scenes footage years ago, like, it's a very basic effect, right? You dig a hole, you have him stand in it, you put the fake legs behind him, you have him lean forward so that he's, you know, with the toes of the fake legs facing down, and then you just lean back.
Yep.
And then you add the sound effects, and it's awesome. It's such a simple effect. And I will say, you know, it's interesting. I know part 7, which would have been 87, right? Yep. That one is always pointed to as the beginning of the end for the level of gore in the series, as far as like MPAA and it really started to crack down, right?
Yep.
Because I know that one got really taken across the coals. This movie, though, may have been by design, because I know that Tom McLaughlin has talked about, like, he was trying to create almost like a gothic vibe, and I don't know if he was downplaying the gore per se, because there's some definite gore in this, but it does feel like it's tamped down a bit. But I feel like this may have been more an artistic choice than a censorship MPAA sticking their nose where it doesn't belong choice. I guess it did belong, but it doesn't make it any less annoying. And I feel like with this, like, first, it's the brain, like when he crushes the one deputy's head.
Yeah.
And yet you see some brain out of his nostril after he's dead.
And, you know, I never realized that before until this past time when I watched it. I was like, you
thought it was boogers.
Yeah. I was like, that's gray matter coming out of his nose.
Yeah. It looks like snot mixed with gray matter, which is disgusting.
Yeah.
But it's like you didn't see it. You just kind of heard the cracking. Whereas in part three, I think, what was his name? Rick or whatever, the love interest, potential love interest for Dana Kimmel's character. You know, his head, if remember, good, I know they were doing it because of the 3D, but his eyes literally popped out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do feel like by this one, because five is fairly, like, that was God goes all out with the gore too. And obviously four definitely does and so on and so forth. But I feel like this one is like tamer when it comes to some of that stuff. There's a lot of the aftermath. Like, you get a lot of after they've been dead, you see a head, you know, fall out of a car. I mean, yeah, you do see somebody's head get twisted off, but it's, again, it's like you see a twist and then we cut away and we cut back and it's obvious the way Jason's holding it, it was taken off, but it's not super graphic. It's not super, like, they're not holding on it so much, which a lot of these movies, I think they do. They always were notorious for me. Oh, they're just gore movies and all this stuff. But most of the gore was after the fact. Like, you find, Final Girl finds all the bodies.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I, for me personally, the back bend, what is your favorite?
I liked the court death scene. Mainly because, you know, they got that Alice Cooper song playing, the Teenage Frankenstein.
Teenage Frankenstein.
I remember when that came out. I had
Constrictor album.
Yep. I played that thing out. My cassette tape was worn out. Tell you.
One of the first music video, my cousin Chris, same one, made a VA because I didn't have, I would stay with my dad and they didn't have, I guess he must not have had cable at that point at that house with my grandmother's house. And so he made a VHS copy of stuff off MTV. And this had been around 1986. So these are like the first music videos I ever remember watching in regular circulation. But I remember on that tape was Papa Don't Preach, Run DMC, Aerosmith, Walk This Way, These Dreams by Heart, and Man Behind the Mask with Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
I watched the hell out of that thing, man. Good. It was definitely before I'd seen the movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, I love that. I love the music in this thing.
Yeah, this is in that whole scene with, you know, I'm not the whole scene with Court's love interest or sex interest, whatever.
Was that Nikki?
She gets her head smashed through the, didn't care too much about that. That scene reminds me of a scene in Nightmare on Elm Street, where Freddy's face is coming out of the wall.
Yes, actually, yes, 100% agree with that. Yep.
How he just casually, Jason just casually walks up behind Court, right? Court's driving and jamming along, and Court looks up in a rear view and knife to the temple, you know?
But in classic fashion for all of these movies, and I pointed this out to my kid, I said, people do not have peripheral vision in this world.
They don't.
They just don't have it. He's standing right in your peripheral vision and nobody notices him. I mean, you know that you're driving along and it's anything catches your eye in the rearview mirror, you immediately look at it. There's nothing that, first off, nothing that big is going to just suddenly be behind you and you not notice.
And there's that one whole scene where Lisbeth, I think it is played by Nancy McLaughlin. She's walking, she's in the, you know, she takes the little girl back to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And on her side, Jason is at the window. But like you said, they have no peripheral vision, because if they did, you would plainly, even when she's walking out and Jason's following her in the windows. I'm like, how can you not see that?
Yeah. And not only that, she also just doesn't. Okay. All of us have had that. You've had that feeling like somebody's watching you.
Yeah.
You get, here's a newsflash, everyone. We have, like, you know, ancestors and evolution. And, you know, at one point, all had this sense of, like, intuition and instinct. We still get that. We still get those moments where you're like, no, somebody's watching you.
Yep.
You feel it. How did she not notice, like, on any level that this dude is standing right there? Now, I get it. It's for the movie.
Yeah.
But it's still ridiculous. Now, I would want to say, so you mentioned a little girl. This is the only, and, like, correct me if I'm wrong, because maybe I'm just remembering this wrong. This is the only Friday 13th movie where we get actual little kids.
Actual kids, yeah.
Yeah, because I think all the other ones, it's like they're setting up the camp before the campers get there, or they're in a place that's adjacent to the camp, but they're not in the actual camp.
Yeah.
And so this is the only one where we got, which I think adds a really cool layer to it. Please see the earlier line that I mentioned. Again, I still think that's fantastic the way it's delivered. But the little girl, this is where I go back to, there's no way Tom McLaughlin didn't do this on purpose. The little girl who is, you know, the blonde, she actually reminded me of Heather O'Rourke from Poltergeist. Yeah. She had that look. Her name is Nancy. She wakes up from a nightmare about a killer who was after her and was everywhere. And this is 2 years after Nightmare on Elm Street.
You think that's a reference?
It was totally a reference. It had to be a reference. I would love to ask him. I said that has to be a reference. Sheriff Garris, in real life, Tom McLaughlin and Mick Garris are very good friends and were back then. So I'm fairly confident that maybe that character was named. That could be a coincidence, but I feel like that would make sense.
Yeah.
God, there was another one. There was another reference to something that I was like, oh, he had to mean that. But to me, the Nancy thing was absolute. Oh, like yeah, that,
absolutely.
That had to be.
It had to be. Yeah. And that's when, let me see, she goes back. Lizbeth goes back to the cabin after that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she gets
slaughtered.
Right. Yeah.
So now is Lizbeth, is that, that was, if that's McLaughlin's wife, was she the redhead at the beginning with in the car?
Oh, maybe, or hold on. Maybe I got the wrong person then.
No, that's okay. I just want to make sure. Cause I know McLaughlin's wife. I'm 99% sure. I could be wrong though. That's why I always leave out that 1%. Cause it's always a possibility. I'm really wrong on this, but correct if I'm wrong. I think his wife was the lady at the beginning or towards the beginning, the one, the VW Bug with Tony Goldwyn, who's probably the biggest name that came out of this movie when you think about it.
Yeah.
And I'm fairly certain, because I know she's a redhead, and she's the one that gets the spear through the face. True. The lady who gets...
Who was that one that takes the girl back to the bed
there? Yeah, no, you're right. She was one of the counselors. I don't think that's... Is that Katie? No, Katie's the one of the paintballers. I'm trying to remember which one. Sissy was the girl who gets her head twisted off. That's Renee Jones. Paula. Carrie, what? Her defense, like IMDb, there's no picture of her.
That's why. But yeah. All of that's what it was. Yeah. And she's one to get slaughtered there. That's right. Okay.
Yeah. And what's funny with her, but funny with her death is that the implication, and this is what I mean by, I feel like it was a choice because her death is probably the most brutal, or at least the implication of it is, because the way the blood goes across the glass. Okay. Well, we've seen that before, but then all of a sudden her body just gets chucked into that window and flops over, and the way he moves and grabs her and just ganks her back the way he does.
Yep.
And then later we don't see anything else, but then later the inside of that cabin is an utter bloodbath. Yeah. It's like, there's nothing left. Like, he just ripped her apart.
Yeah. And if they would have showed that, boy, that would have been, really gory.
Yeah. Like, I feel like, and that's why I said, I feel like this one should know from McLaughlin, did he get a lot of pushback from the MPA? And I'm sure we could find old issues of Fango or something that talked about it. But I feel like a lot of the gore was artistic choice as opposed to being dictated, you know, by some board somewhere. So whereas I know with John Carl Beekler and Part 7, a lot of the kills and the effects that he had ended up getting on the cutting room floor because they were just kept giving him, we're going to give him an X. So, and he had to deliver an R picture. But the point is this one, I've always thought her death in particular was the most, even though it was off screen, essentially was the most brutal.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was young and I saw this, it bothered me because you don't see her, you never see her body, but
If there's anything left,
do you see her body?
No.
Is it like laying on the floor or anything? I don't remember.
I don't think so. No.
Yeah. But it's such a, I mean, it's bad. I mean, it's like, I mean, it's almost like, you know, it reminds me of, it's Len, the Johnny Depp character in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Like what's left after him. Like, it's, of course, in that it's ridiculous because it's a fountain of blood, but within the context of the world of Nightmare on Elm Street, makes sense. It's dreams, it's nightmares. So even though it doesn't seem to make sense how much blood's there, but that's kind of what this looks like. It's just insane.
Absolutely. It is. And I agree that that is the most, because everything else is just it's a court gets stabbed in the head.
Yeah. Chopped head off, you know.
Stabbed and thrown. And
we get a triple head chop, though.
Yeah.
With
that was good.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. But I thought that was hilarious. Yeah.
And then
by the way, they all, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I did want to say that all three of my kids, one of them actually said, you know, Dad, I'm glad you've showed us old movies for a long time, because I feel like I can actually just watch this and enjoy it and not just want to make fun of it. Now, they did goof on some things, which quite frankly, so did I, because there's some things in it that are funny.
Yeah, there is.
But that's part of the fun, right? Back to the audience experience you had, you know, the equivalent of throwing popcorn at the screen and yeah. laughing at people's stupidity. That's part of what makes these movies fun. And so, but all three of them, they asked me, I was like, so what'd you guys think? Oh, we loved it, man. It was great. They thought it was fun. So that made my cold little heart.
Yeah, that the whole scene with Tommy's head in Megan's lap the whole time while she's driving. And,
oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That, how can you not laugh at something like that? You know, I'm like, yeah. Come on.
Explain the logic. So we're coming up to a roadblock. Okay. Okay. They start shooting at the car, get down. That would make sense to me. Or yeah. They haven't spotted you yet, get down. Although once you go up to the roadblock, they would see him. Let's just go with it for a second. But she ultimately knows they saw him because she speeds away and now they're chasing her.
Yep.
So what's the point of, I'm not saying he was complaining or had or should have complained. I'm just saying it doesn't make sense why, other than she was just using it as a flirtatious thing to do. I mean,
I remember that scene in the book.
Because, okay.
You know, as a 13-year-old, of course, you're reading a scene about this. And I was like, oh, yeah. But they go into detail. Her in the book, her pants were much tighter.
Gotcha.
Because you could see stuff. Are we implying
that it might have been a reference to a certain Saharan animal that holds water in its hump?
In its toe. But the whole scene was from the time that she picked him up, she's like, no, get your head down so nobody sees you.
Oh, I gotcha. Which makes more sense if you think about it. Like, logically, if you're going to do something like that, not in that moment. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
But, you know, we have the final couple. I guess you can call it the final couple, right?
Yeah.
At the end.
Yep.
Tommy Jarvis finally manages this rock that he is pushing. Holy, I was like, damn, dude, you're gonna put that rock in the boat. It's going to break right through the damn boat.
Yeah, my boy's been doing some CrossFit.
I'm telling you. He's been doing something in that crazy camp he was at.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he finally gets it in there, you know, the chain. And this, how he dispatches, I guess. I don't know. It's not really dispatch. It's he traps Jason, I guess.
Sure.
You know, because he's the one that actually killed Jason in part four. So he's like, Jason, it's me you want. You know, and he's getting ready to, Jason was getting ready to crush Megan's head, it looked like, too.
Sure.
Right. And so, of course, Jason heads out to the water and, you know, some shit's going to, you know, when he throws that gas in the water and he lights it.
Yeah.
I remember after I saw this, I was like, would that possible? Really happen?
Yeah.
So I remember me and my cousin, dumbass, is trying to do it in the swimming pool. Wow. We got it beaten that day. I tell you that.
Did it work? That's the important part.
We didn't get a chance to actually light it. We were putting gasoline into the swimming pool and his dad came out.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I said to my kids, I was like, I wonder if I feel like dumping that in a lake wouldn't just dilute. But one of my kids, again, smarter than me, said, well, it's petroleum based, right? So it would float. So it would burn on the surface. That makes sense. I do not think the amount of gas he poured, it's almost as if he poured just some gas.
Yeah.
And that must be the dirtiest, most polluted lake in the continental United States, because for the level of flame that shot up from that one, I feel like it would have just kind of maybe, there would have been a little flame, and then it would just died out, right? It just kind of got away real fast. But no, for the purposes of this, it definitely was something. Yeah.
It was visually appealing. We'll say that.
Yeah, it looked cool. This is what I feel like. When you make a movie like this, you know what you do? I guarantee you there's a moment where you're all standing around, your production designer and producer, and everybody's standing there like, okay, logically, we all know it's not going to look like this.
Yeah.
Okay, we know if you dump gas, A, if it even burns at all, it's not going to be like this. But it looks cool.
Yeah.
So go with it.
Yeah,
if people have accepted up to this point everything that's happened, they'll go.
If you can accept that Jason has eyes after being resurrected, you can accept that the lake's going to catch on fire.
Exactly.
You know, but then of course with the help of Megan, we get this. I think it's kind of an iconic scene, you know, of Jason chained to that rock, floating at the bottom of the lake.
Yes, yes, it is very much so.
My question is, how deep is the lake? Because in part seven or part eight. He looks like he's down there pretty deep. But in this one here, Megan is just swimming on the surface of the water and he just reaches up and grabs her leg.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Honestly, don't know. Because, I mean, let's be honest, with part eight, well, part seven,
she breaks him free.
She breaks him free. And then does he end up back in the lake?
I think she puts him back in the lake.
Okay. And then so in the beginning, because I know eight, he gets on that one boat, which is how he ends up getting to the. But By the way, so presumably Crystal Lake also is, we aren't going to go down this road, I promise, but isn't even landlocked because how did someone get a boat from
Crystal?
Yeah. Yeah, because never quite understood that. But anyway, all of that aside, I honestly not sure, but I will say, have you ever seen the video of there is a lake in Minnesota where a guy put a Jason from Part Six statue? Have you seen that?
Yes, I have seen that.
Yeah, I actually showed it to my kids right before we started. That's awesome. I think it's so cool to think that you could just be down there scuba dive and minding your own business and like, what the actual hell?
You know, I know they have aquarium decorations you can make with that too.
I've seen a lot of those.
I almost want to get an aquarium just to put one of those in there.
Yeah.
I don't need any fish or nothing.
You have a pool.
Oh yeah.
Life at the bottom of your
pool. Yeah, that'd be awesome. That'd go over really well.
Yeah.
Especially if you have like one of those natural pools where it's not chlorine based. Yes. Oh yeah. That'd go over awesome.
That'd be great. by the way, did you know Jennifer Cook, who played Megan, retired from acting the same year this movie came out?
Yep.
I didn't know that. For some reason she seemed, and I know it's only from this movie because I can't think of anything else I've ever seen her in. But yet, I feel like she's somebody who's been around a lot since then, but she hasn't. And but she just wanted to have a family and probably not be part of Hollyweird anymore. Yeah. And, you know, who could.
I know that they tried to get that same guy. I guess I was reading the trivia. They tried to get the same guy from Part Five to reprise the role of Tommy, but he was a born again Christian, didn't want to have anything to do with horror movies or something anymore.
You make your choices.
It's okay.
You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, as a result, we got Tom Matthews in. Not to knock, I think it's John Shepherd as the actor. And he was fine. Like, his performance was fine for what it was. I always thought it was, and I guess they probably, I don't know, have they ever, I'm sure Corey Feldman has talked about it because that dude talks about everything.
Yeah.
But did they ever explain why, did they try to get Corey Feldman? Because I know he's at the very beginning of Five.
Yeah. Just
did they try to get him back?
I don't think so.
Or was it because I think he went to do the Goonies, right? Wasn't that why they had it for like just a day or something because he was doing the Goonies? Yeah. So, yeah, I think his career was kind of blowing up, and they were like, we can't afford him anymore.
No more Friday the 13th. Kind of like Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for his, you know, like I said, John Shepherd not doing it. At the end of the day, as a result, Tom Matthews got the gig. I've heard, I know there was I can't remember which one it was, because, you know, there are all these fan films that pop up.
Yeah.
Never Hike Alone, right? And then there's several other ones. And I don't think anybody's done it yet, but I could have sworn one of them was trying to do something where they could get Tom Matthews in it. And it was going to be like a Tommy Jarvis continuation kind of thing.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it would be cool. That'd be really cool. Yeah, I would dig that.
That would be.
But yeah. But yeah, I did not know that about Megan, Jennifer Cook. I didn't know she retired that soon.
Maybe she's like, I'm done with this crap. If this is the kind of movies I'm going to be making, I'm done.
Well, little did she know, she was in my opinion, basically the best Friday the 13th.
Yeah, my opinion.
That's my opinion too. Sorry. I love Part One. I love Part Two. I love Part Three. I love Part Four. Part Five, I definitely don't love, but feel like I should probably rewatch it with a different mindset because there is things about it that I enjoy. Seven, I always remember, weirdly, Seven is the one that I like some things in it, but I feel like I remember that almost being not, I know boring is a strong word, but I just feel like I remember it not engaging me to the degree that any of the other ones had up to that point.
Yeah, I know in Seven, it was the overbearing mother that was very abusive to her daughter almost to an extent that
manipulating her.
It's actually her dad comes out of the lake at the end of that one and pulls Jason back into the lake.
Doesn't he look like totally normal?
Yeah.
Is that like, it's like he's been down there for 20 years or something, but he looks totally normal.
Totally normal.
And then Part Eight, as we've established, is goofy as all get out, but I have a soft spot for it.
So do I.
And then 9, I've got my own weird nostalgic soft spot for that one, and I enjoy 10. Saw that in the theater too, and I kind of like the remake. So yeah, honestly, Friday the 13th is probably for me because Halloween, you always will have Halloween Resurrection, and you always have the Rob Zombie Halloween movies. No offense.
Oh boy.
Well, I love those. No offense.
And you always have Halloween Ends.
Hey. Well, actually, I was going to make an Evil Dies Tonight joke, but that would be a Halloween Kills. So I just feel like this series is one of the most consistent until the MPAA got involved, which isn't really the series' fault per se. And it does. I agree with you when you said like after 6, we do get a bit of a tonal change too, because I feel like after 6, they're willing to take more chances with the ludicrous elements of the story. Like, let's throw a Carrie in there. Let's let's, you know, have him go to Manhattan, but somehow end up on a boat and whatever. And, you know, and
melt in toxic waste in a sewer.
What's that?
Said in melt in toxic waste in the sewer.
Yeah, and then somehow again turn into like a normal looking little kid.
That's drowning. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so weird.
The whole series, ones that really stand out to me was part 3, because that's where he gets his mask, the hockey mask.
Yes, of course.
Part 6, because that's when he's actually undead, I guess you could say.
Yep.
And then Jason X. I mean, I love Jason X.
Yeah.
Those are my top 3 right there.
Yeah, I'd say for me, it's probably 6. Over the years, 3 has really grown on me a lot. Honestly, it really has. But it's between 3 and 4. That was one that for the longest time I liked it. I appreciated it. But then I revisited it a couple years ago. And I think 4 is like a really good movie. Like, yeah. It's something about 4. There's elements of 2 I really like. I know some people, I know like Matt and Jack's, like, I know Father and Son watch horror. Matt loves 2 as his favorite. And Sackhead Jason is fine, but Hockey Mask Jason. It's so iconic. The Sackhead thing to me, it's like, I think of like the town, the dreaded sundown, you know, what's that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's like, it doesn't feel as unique, whereas the hockey mask, that is, it's like the glove for Freddy. It's like that, or the sweater for Freddy, whatever.
Yeah.
There's just certain, or the white mask for Jason. I just feel like, I mean, I'm sorry, Michael Myers. I feel like there's just certain things that made those series iconic. And that for, so I'm more of a hockey mask guy. So I think with 2, I know it's Jason and I know it's the same series and it's a great movie, but I always feel like it's weirdly not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's wearing overalls and he's got half like a bearded face.
Kind of. Yeah. 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 You know what it reminds me of? It's almost like Wrong Turn too.
Yep.
Like, he's like one of the characters from Wrong Turn mixed with the Town of the Dread Sundown. So someone told me Friday the 13th Part 2 was a movie that was obviously trying to rip off Friday the 13th, but was like one of the best ones that ever did it. I'd be like, okay, yeah, I see that. I get it. But I just have always felt like, because in my head as a kid, it was always hockey mask, hockey mask, hockey mask, hockey mask.
Oh, yeah.
So when I finally, and again, because I saw them all in order like I did, when I finally got to 2, because I didn't get to 2, I was one of the, I ended up seeing 2 probably about the time I finally saw, when I was seeing like maybe 7 and 8, you know what I mean? I got 2 and 1 actually. I didn't see until like after, you know, like several years after I'd seen the first, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then possibly even 8. And then I saw 1 and 2. I like 1. I think it's fine for what it is. I watched it many times. It is the one that got it rolling, but obviously, you know, for a variety of reasons, it is different than the other ones. And then 2, again, for me, it's got some great moments in it. It's got great characters. I think actually debatable if that's the strongest final girl was in that one with Amy Steele, because I think she really is good.
Yeah.
but yeah, I don't know. I think it's the Sackhead thing. And I know some people love that.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That's not my thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Hockey Mask Jason is the Jason. And that was the big giveaway in part 5 of why you knew it wasn't really Jason, because the hockey mask had the blue marks on it instead of the red marks.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Thank you for saying that. That reminded me. So, do you think this is on purpose? Maybe not. Maybe I'm giving a boy McLaughlin way too much credit, but take the credit, Tom. I think you deserve it. So, the name of the killer, do you remember the name, the actual character name of who it turns out to be in Friday the 13th Part 5? Sorry if I'm putting you on the spot.
That's
the EMT guy. Do you remember what his real name was?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a character in this that has the exact same name. Now, it's a simple name, so it's very, could just be a coinkydink. But the really kind of nerdy, Eddie Deason looking dude,
Roy,
is Roy. And Roy is also the name of that of the killer in part 5.
Yep.
And there's a part of me that wonder, because that character is played so goofy, like for laughs, right? We're supposed to be, you know, it's he's like so like pooping his pants in reaction to Jason.
Yeah.
And I wonder, could that have been a little like wink and a nod? Cause so many people are angry about how part 5 played out and that it wasn't the real Jason. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Like almost as a form of mockery of that character. And again, I am probably
could be
really, really making stuff up at this point, but I just never noticed that before until we were doing this. I'm like, wait a minute, his name was Roy. Yeah, it could be a quick,
wow.
But why not Bob? Why not Bill? Why not Tom. Why
not
Roy?
Joel?
Not Joel. Why not Roy?
Yeah.
But yeah. And it, we only kind of hit on this for briefly, and I don't remotely mean to take over your show, but I did want to say CJ Graham as Jason, I think is great. Like, I think he's, this look of Jason in general is probably my favorite, like this design,
yep,
where way he looks with that almost military, you know, the green jacket, yep, the hunter belt, the way the mask looks, everything about it. I just like
the look, the aesthetic.
It's design awesome of Jason. Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome. Now, yeah. I know that, you know, Payne Hodder, sure, is given a lot of, because you did 7, 8, and 9.
Sure. And 10.
Yeah. And 10. That's right. And, you know, he's given a lot because he added something different to the whole cadence of Jason Voorhees.
Sure.
But CJ Graham, you know, coming into this and playing Jason Voorhees in this, and I think he did a great job. And I think you're right. He looks spectacular. Everything, even though he's got fresh eyes.
Yeah, he's got very clean eyes. Well, and that's the thing. Kane Hodder, I think, well, he's always given the credit, and I think rightfully so, of giving Jason kind of as close as you could to a personality. Yeah. He added the heavy breathing thing, so he's super intense, and yep, he's always like, you know, he's like a sense of rage under the surface, which is good. Like, really fits that character. But I feel like CJ Graham, I don't know if he's given enough credit, because, and I really noticed it this time, he also gave some character to Jason, like in the way he reacts to things and like looks at, like when he gets shot with a paint gun and he just looks down and looks back up real slow. He also, I think, toys with his prey a little bit. So when the caretaker is stumbling through the woods and that rock comes, you know, kind of out of nowhere and catches his attention and he looks down at it, obviously Jason did that.
Yeah.
So there's this sense like Jason in this one has more of a personality even than I think he did in any of the previous movies. All the previous movies to me, he's just sort of, you know, stalking and killing, and that's fine. And he does have some things he does, but this is the one where you first start getting those hints of like the way he, you know, turns his head or way he, and I mean, obviously a lot of it was in the direction I'm sure that McLaughlin gave him, but it just seems like, minus that sort of heaving, hulking aspect that Hodder brought to him, there was those beginnings of like the, yeah, how we think of when we think of Jason Voorhees.
So we've learned that it took Jason Voorhees to die and be resurrected to come back with some personality and some attitude.
Basic is what we're saying. Yes. It's basically what's going to have to happen to me.
Yeah, good. Well, Joel, that brings us to the end of the movie. And, end of this episode of the podcast. And once again, I want to thank you for coming on over and talking about this spectacular film with me. Now, if anybody was so inclined to find you, do you have anything else going on?
If they really have nothing better to do with their lives and are really wanting to subject themselves to more of me, then yes, I do. But first of all, let me say thank you for having me on. It's an honor. This is the second time I've been on your podcast, so I really appreciate you having me on again. And I'm really glad we got to cover this movie. Like when you said you were going to do a Friday 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, and I'm like, sweet, because... Honestly, it's like when I was on HMP, they had already covered, you know, the franchise review on Friday. So I knew I wasn't going to be a part of that. And then never like been a part of one of those. So I was like, since this is my personal favorite, it was really cool to get to do that. So I really appreciate you doing that.
Oh, yeah,
so
thank absolutely.
You. Yeah, you can, of course, check out Retro Movie Geek, where I'm over there with Daryl and Peter. And we act like, you know, sort of like latchkey kids whose parents never came home. So that's that show. And then Terror on the Tube, which I also do with Peter, and Allison, the horror unicorn. She definitely, that show has got a lot less of the out of controlness, I feel like, the Retro Movie Geek does, but it's fun where we talk about made for TV horror and suspense films from the 70s, 80s, and now twice
the 90s.
The 1990s. And let's just say the second 1990s one, which as we record this, that episode dropped today, was not great. But that's a discussion for another day. And of course, Jay and the Dead's new horror movies. Check that out. I'm one of his horror Avengers on that particular program, which is nice. Awesome. It's always a fun time reviewing and talking about movies with those guys. And of course, Mom and Pop Video Shop, where I, with my buddy Tyson, we are on YouTube. That is a YouTube show that we are doing now. And we have, it goes out every Monday. And we're starting to add in some in October, actually Friday the 13th in October, we're going to do our first official live stream for that. And yeah, so definitely go check that out. Mom and Pop Video Shop. Be sure to subscribe and see what we're doing over there. If you like that, it's kind of like set in a makeshift video store environment. And we talk about old movies and current movies. We're going to actually be reviewing some new stuff that's coming out, and a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah, you're busy.
Good. You're a little bit.
You're getting up to them Daryl levels.
I joked with him actually recently. I made that comment. I was like, wow, Daryl, I'm almost up to you. What are you, like 564 on the podcast? And
all right. Well, that's it. Joel, thanks again. And out there, sweet dreams and love, peace, and chicken grease.
As we reluctantly bid adieu to the twisted carnival of horrors and the maniacal laughter echoing in the shadows, I hope your heart is still racing and your nerves are electrified. Clowns with their painted smiles and hidden malevolence remind us that terror can wear a colorful mask. Remember, in the circus of the macabre, the line between delight and dread is razor thin. Until next time, when we venture into the darkest corners of the human psyche once more, keep an eye on the corners of your vision and a flashlight close at hand, for you never know when the circus may return to town. Sleep with one eye open, dear listeners, and may your dreams be free of painted grins and red noses.
This concludes our broadcast day. Good night, and God bless America.